The other day I noticed something that maybe some of you have noticed. I noticed that birdsong stops the world. I think I first heard about this concept of stopping the world from the writings of Carlos Castaneda. But then I heard it in a Zen context from my first teacher. And in Castaneda's writings, and to some extent, my first teacher, it sounded like it was something that you can do. And I thought that for a while, but I no longer think that. You could say stopping the world is just another expression for returning home. But it can be quite striking. It's as though, indeed, everything stopped. And the reason now I doubt that it's something that you do is because it seems to me that the world is stopped. And because of the human habit of having a little dialogue with ourselves most of the time, or if you prefer a dialogue with the world, although mostly the world isn't answering. It comes to seem like that dialogue is sort of covering the earth. Blah, 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 blah. And so when you could be carrying along perfectly happily with your dialogue, and you might notice, you might hear a bird singing, and you might notice that everything stops. Would you like a little more volume? Yeah. You want to crank it up there a little bit, Larry? Thank you. And although everything stopping isn't different from what's happening right now, there can be a point of noticing, actually, how still things really are, even in the midst of stuff apparently happening all the time. And in our Zazen practice, it's really a matter of aligning the body-mind with that stillness. I noticed that somebody had posted Twitter, I think, periodically Suzuki Roshi's quotes crop up there. Somebody tweeted the quote about what Suzuki Roshi called the waves in the mind, which is more or less what I'm talking about, the tide, you know. And how he said, you know, it really, it's kind of like we're responsible for that. We are like a kid with a stick by a pond who just loves to poke in the mud and throw things, you know. And the kid might notice, though, that when he or she stops doing that, the water is very still. And there are reminders of this all the time. So now I'm a little worried, though, that I may inspire some people to go looking for that. You could put a chair out on the front porch and wait for a bird to chirp and then see, did that stop everything? Of course, that won't work very well. It's better if we're surprised. And I do think this is actually happening all the time. But our karmic momentum, which is a phrase I know I've used before, is so insistent that it's difficult for us to allow these perceptions of stillness to arise. There's always, you know, after something, going somewhere, doing something, worrying about something, wondering if this week we'll win the lottery. And so I was going to say this during Zazen, but I suddenly thought, oh, maybe you guys don't have that tradition. Oh, you do? Oh, okay. Well, maybe next time. But I was going to say, when we sit, it's like, you know, sitting next to a creek or a stream. You know, water. There's water sound. There's music, kind of water. And we don't have to interfere at all. In the same way, the stream of our consciousness, this dialogue I'm talking about, we don't have to interfere with it at all. So Suzuki Roshi was saying, if, you know, if we try to do something about that, it's actually just more waves. And to trust profoundly our own stillness, really, it's a kind of Chinese expression from the head top to the toe tips, completely trust our innate nature, sometimes people say Buddha nature, allows us to be sitting by the stream and let the music play, not interfere. And notice how without our interference, how still things are. some of our Zen stories. I don't know, maybe all of them are actually about this. But there's a, I don't know, maybe it's a kind of concession to human enjoyment, that it's kind of fun if it surprises you. You weren't expecting it. You're just walking along, admiring the spring, and a sound shows you how quiet everything is. So things are, you know, pretty quiet here now. You guys aren't being all raucous and shouting and throwing things. So part of our practice is to get together in a way that reflects this profound stillness of everything. And that is life-changing. It reveals a perspective on our life and this universe that's quite striking. And the more our conscious life, our life experience is inspired by, illuminated by, uplifted by this perception of stillness, the more the sense of being like burdened with stuff melts away. Our teaching basically is that this is what Buddha did, Buddha Shakyamuni. This was his discovery, or anyway, a way of talking about his discovery. I saw the other day that is now as a kind of a scholarly trend, and you all know this story of Buddha and, you know, Buddha the prince and a wealthy family, and his father wanted him to be the king one day, but that guy who showed up when Siddhartha was born said, you know, watch out, this guy could either be a hell of a king or a hell of a sage. So, I'm just telling you. And the king thought, oh no, I don't like that sage thing at all, so I'm going to arrange things so that this life we have in our palace is going to be just irresistible. And of course, then there's Buddha sneaks away, sneaks downtown, just like a good teenager, and sees some side of life that he hadn't seen before, and that kind of turned him around. So apparently that his story is part of how Buddhism, what we call Buddhism, developed. And now it seems like there's an earlier level of the Buddha story, where mostly a lot of that stuff wasn't even in there. The kingdom and the prediction about being a king or a sage, and Buddha getting married and having a child. This is all apparently later. And the earlier story is kind of simpler. And it's about this guy who, for whatever reason, decided he wanted to look at life really, really closely. So the part about him abandoning his wife and child, apparently that came later on. And what you get is another of these universal stories about, you know, the hero's journey. If you've heard of this, Carl Gustav Jung had a lot to say about that, and noticing that practically every culture has this theme of turning into the unknown, walking into the unknown in order to drink from the wellspring of life, and encountering some, dragons or demons or whatever, and not like beating them or, whacking them over the head with a stick, just his own simple nature and heart allowed him to move them aside and continue his journey. And when he returns, he's like, well, nothing special, really. He's like a complete person who has drunk from that wellspring and who knows that that's all there is. That's where it all comes from, all the time. That living water is always flowing. So for whatever reason, people decided to add to that story, but at its heart, it's yet another hero's journey. And that's a journey certainly all of you all are making. Maybe it's, maybe everyone's making that journey. And it used to be that there were particular people whose job it was to aid people to begin that journey, usually when they were like, in their teens or something, or the Greeks called these the mystagogues. That's the word they used. And the mystagogue's journey was, along with, students, maybe it's not the right word, but initiates. Pointing them towards what they would have to encounter in order to recognize themselves as a complete person. So the mystagogue would basically point. And the would-be initiate would maybe say, I'm sorry, it's dark in there. I don't want to go there. Thank you. And the mystagogue would say, it's okay. I'm here, and that's the way, right over there. But the mystagogue has lost its place in our current society. Sometimes it's been taken up by psychotherapists. Sometimes they can have that role. Clergy people of various kinds. School teachers. That role can manifest all kinds of places and times. So we don't use that word anymore, and our kind of materialist society no longer prizes that journey explicitly. And as a result, young people, you know, and like in this country anyway, high schoolers maybe, there isn't anyone there to say, okay, here's what you have to do next. And yeah, pizza and video games, that's okay, but there's something else you need to do. And of course, everybody knows that, actually. But there's no one who's standing at that place helping these young people along and saying, okay, once you're done with your video game tonight, you and I have to have a talk. And as a result, it's sort of like, you know, come high school, it's like somebody took a bucket of marbles and just threw them onto the floor and they go all over the place. There's nobody around saying, okay, let's make sure the marbles kind of, you know, roll in a really good direction. So, I don't know, but you guys, you know, you may have to be mystagogues. You know, for, I don't know, for who. And you probably don't know either. And it would be good not to walk around thinking, I'm a mystagogue. It's actually not helpful. But you may encounter someone and a little bell will go off. And you'll notice that this person is, their marble is kind of rolling under the furniture and getting stuck. You just may, you know, on a city bus or in a park or in a coffee shop, the occasion may arise where your simple presence with this person will awaken them to something in themselves that will enable them to begin their journey. Nothing that necessarily you'll say to them. Just your openness to where they are and who they are in their life. Your willingness to meet them heart to heart. And that will be the cue, the key, the spark. And they may not thank you. At least not right away. But you all know the story of ancestor Dongshan and he left his teacher before he was awake, really. And, you know, he'd journeyed maybe quite far away. And somehow this creek I was talking about, he was by such a creek and happened to look in the water and saw his own face, and that was the spark for him. And his teacher, Yunyan Tansheng, his mystagogue, was way off somewhere else where he'd come from. So Dongshan just turned back in that direction and bowed. And that was his thanks. I think by that time, Yunyan had already died. So don't wait for thanks. Just be there. in the way that your zazen practice supports. Don't look for any special reaction. Just let your heart tell their heart that you too are on that journey. And that can be deeply supportive and comforting for people without their knowing it. Yes?
Marma? Like the reverse of the Narcissus story.
Yeah, Narcissus got kind of lost, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so that's another reason why it's good if a mystagogue at the right moment can come along while you're staring into the water, your own reflection, and tap you on the shoulder and say, okay, enough of that. There's something else you have to do. Yeah. I don't mean to imply that all of you aren't doing it already. In fact, I'm quite sure you are. But you need to be able to trust that without, counting on too many bells and whistles, too many skyrockets. As for whatever reason, some people's lives or practice unfold in the way that they will settle on what was to them a particularly compelling moment in their life. And in the Buddhist context, they will say, oh, I had an awakening experience. And in certain forms of certain Buddhist lineages, sometimes there's another person, the mystagogue, who will say, yeah, good. But, really, in Buddhist lineages, pretty much it's the Zen folks who do that, and the others not so much. Most of the other lineages, the teacher instructs, and the student practices, and the teacher is there to encourage and offer some guidance. And the maturing of that student's practice is just what happens. The teacher does not make that happen. Our Zen stories do seem to have, there seem to be these occasions where the so-called teacher does something and the student is like, oh, now I'm enlightened. But I don't know if you've noticed, there's never any detail there. I don't know if you noticed that, but in these stories, it never says, well, the teacher whacked him on the head, and then he, this is what happened in his psychological unfolding. It's like, no, they don't say that. It just says, and so-and-so entered the way, for instance. So-and-so experienced awakening. There are no details. Which is good, because the more details there are, the more you start to think, well, I have to have that experience like that person had. Otherwise, my practice is no good. And that is a big mistake. So I was very happy when I noticed, hey, these stories never say, and this is what happened to that person. All it says is, and so-and-so entered the way. Like that. And you could say, for them, the world stopped. Or they saw the world stopped. And all you got to do is keep practicing, and your feet will be on the path, and your life will unfold as you might say it's meant to unfold. And you don't have to worry about what someone else's experience might have been. There's, of course, a famous book. All right, I confess, this is the first Zen book I read. And one section is all of these stories about so-and-so had an enlightenment. And I first read that book when I was 17. I thought it was... I haven't said the title. Anyway, I was 17 a long time ago, so I'll give you some cues. But anyway, I thought that was very cool. And later on, I started to wonder whether that was so cool. Whether that would actually cause people to try to figure out how they could get themselves to feel that way, like this person in this story. One person said, and then the room and Roshi and I all dissolved in a dazzling stream of illumination. For a moment, I was alone. I alone was. It's like, bitchin', man, how do I get that to happen to me? And it's like, okay, you know, that's actually not the point. And one famous Zen luminary many years ago said to me, it will be as though you were struck down the middle with an axe. And I thought later, I don't think I want to be struck down the middle with an axe. And someone else, another Zenist I know, went to see a teacher who's kind of had that style and said, man, it was really great. It was like sitting in front of an open blast furnace. And I was thinking, why would anybody sit in front of an open blast furnace? So I was like, okay, whatever floats your boat. But don't be misled into thinking, oh, I have to feel that way so I can write these stories. And then my hat blew off and you know, it's like, never mind that stuff. As Suzuki Roshi said, of course, our practice is actually, it's supposed to help you find your own way. Your own way. And the challenge there usually is that people think they already know what that is. So in Zen, they have this thing where they put people in these environments where the way they usually do things is sort of like, okay, don't do that anymore and do it this way instead. It's like, well, why do I have to do that? Well, just because, actually, believe it or not, this way that we're showing you, this will help you find your own way. That's kind of paradoxical, but that's Zen for you. Paradox. So it's nighttime now, and I don't think I hear any birds singing, but maybe on your way home, you'll hear a nightingale. Do you have nightingales in Sacramento?
No.
Mockingbirds. They sometimes... Bats. Bats I haven't heard sing exactly, but... They do chirp, very high. And of course, those poor nightingales, they'd probably rather be asleep, but people have outside lights on, and so they go hang out with the light, which they must be exhausted. Anyway, who knows what you will hear? And in that apparently brief space, you may notice, golly, nothing's really moving. Everything's silent. Even things that are speaking are silent. Or not, you know. I'm not supposed to be putting a lot of weird ideas in your head, so maybe I'll shut up now. Yes.
Oh, it's for the recording? Okay. At different times in our lives, we need different kinds of mystigods. So for those teenagers mm-hmm. who are jazzed by the world around them, the mystigod of the bright lights and the exotica
mm-hmm.
is the gateway. For more mature folks
mm-hmm.
who are curious about our own way, that is not the mystagogue.
Well, it's mystagogue, G-O-G-U-E, mystagogue. The issue there, though, is, you know, this is not to criticize our young people, but there is it's kind of an abyss to cross from the extremely beautiful and powerful, what you might call faith of the child, to the faith of the adult. And some people can make that journey themselves. But my impression is it's really good if someone else is there for them and can help them start to make that, you know, encounter that abyss and realize, you know what, God is not going to make everything all right. That's just not how it works. I'm sorry. And you're not a kid anymore. So now what? And it, you know, young people will not need any encouragement to enjoy what life offers them in this country, unless, of course, they're poor or persons of color, then maybe it's not so fun. But again, this is not a criticism. This is just to say that something quite vital to a healthy society, I think we've lost our grip on. And of course, we may have other opinions.
No, I agree with you. Mm. And I'm just wondering, though, to entice them,
mm-hmm.
do we not need to speak in their language? Do we not need to have a mystagogue that with which they can respond?
Yes, well, you're right. And that's why I put a lot of faith in the random encounter rather than say, oh, no, we got to get all those kids to come in here to Valley Stream Zen Center. It's like, no, not really. But if you meet such a person, You may, as I say, you may have a little feeling like, oh, this person feels like they're kind of drifting in the wind and they're not real happy about it. And what if I, you know, maybe I'll just have a cup of coffee with them. Maybe I'll sit next to them on the bus and this is a little dramatic example, but I was on the way to the train today. And I was walking down Main Street in San Francisco, and there was a young man standing against one of the pillars, the bus station there. And I thought, well, something funny here. And I noticed he was like having trouble standing up. And I noticed he was doing this. I thought, oh shit, I think he's OD'd. And I walked by, and I thought, okay, let's see, what can I do here? And I turned around, and I thought, and just as I was about to do that, this young African-American man came up to him and said, hey, how you doing? You doing all right? And I thought, perfect. And then a minute later, this poor young man actually fell down. And I thought, okay, I think they better call somebody because he's going to go under. This is, you know, I could have done that, I suppose. And I was about ready to go back there and see what can I do. And this other person just showed up out of nowhere and said, hey, you okay? And that's what I'm talking about. The random encounter can be the turning point for someone's whole life without your planning on anything of the kind.
Mio, the whole theme of your talk has been about sitting and aligning yourself with the stillness, right?
I didn't know I had a theme, but okay, go ahead.
Well, it's the way I took it.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Stillness, or you've used the word quiet, word stopping still. But I'm starting to appreciate that my literal understanding of a word is not always what is being conveyed. So when you talk about stillness and quiet, am I correct? You're not really talking about quiet in the ordinary meaning of the word quiet.
Well, right. Quiet can mean just the absence of sound.
But
that's not quite what I'm getting at.
Okay, exactly.
There's quiet even in the presence of sound.
That's what I thought.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, gotcha.
And that's there, whether we notice or appreciate it or not. But our practice, you might say, draws from that stream.
So you're talking about suchness. It is what it is.
Okay.
I mean, I'm asking.
Suchness, yes, that's one of those Buddhist words.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. I hope that guy made it. Poor kid. I mean, you know, this you hear about this in the news all the time now, but I hadn't actually ever seen it in actual life, this guy going over the edge. And I, people talk about, the opiate crisis or whatever it is. And it's like, I don't very often hear people talk about, okay, what is it that is causing people to seek profound anesthesia from the misery of their lives? Oh, I guess that's it, the misery of their lives. Okay. Yes.
I think it's because the material world that's been offered to them has not satisfied their need.
Alas, right. And this is what I'm talking about. If the mystagogue had been there to say, that stuff's okay, but we got this other thing. Yes.
I just read a really good, interesting article about the opioid crisis.
Yeah.
I wish I could remember the author or the publication, but and he made a really, in you know, he showed that the opiate crisis is strongest in the Rust Belt and in other areas where basically our society is leaving people behind.
Yes.
And you know, just people have no hope, and I mean that's like the worst existential crisis you can have, and your only option is
let's do something to take the edge off here. Pass me that syringe or whatever. And, damn near destroyed China in the 19th century. Damn near destroyed that country. Because, that stuff is powerful. The first time I was introduced to opiate medicines, I had a kidney stone. And I think I only took like 2 or 3 milligrams of dilaudid. And man, I thought, I was actually scared. It was so intense. I thought, this can't be right. Whoa, my whole body is like, oh, whoopee, you know? And it's like, if, you know, if like, if we had today opium dens, I guess we do, I don't know. But now it's like people don't bother with opium anymore. They go right to the other stuff, the refined stuff. But it'd be pretty easy to see a whole room full of couches and people, you know. Man, you know. Oh, in fact, Oliver Sacks tells a great story about that. I don't know if you, the late Oliver Sacks, wonderful psychiatrist. When he was younger, he did a lot of drugs, and especially when he was a medical student. It's like, man, I got my hands on all kinds of stuff here. And he said he got a hold of, I don't know, I guess it was morphine or something, one day. And he went home in the afternoon and took whatever it was. And at first didn't feel much. And then he started looking at his sleeve, and he saw what looked like a medieval jousting tournament with, you know, flags and horses and princesses, and it was absolutely wonderful, and he could hardly take his eyes off it. And finally he decided, okay, that's enough of that. And he looked around and thought, something's funny. What the hell happened? It was 10 o'clock in the morning. The entire night had gone by. Right? He didn't even notice. He said, okay, I'm not doing that again. That's how powerful this stuff is. It opens the door to a whole other world. And the problem is, you can't stay there. Right? When you come back, it's even worse. And next thing you know, it's like, well, I need a little more this time, because you develop a tolerance. Next thing you know, you hit that point where you're respiration is suppressed, and then you're over the edge. Yes?
I think what you're talking about is profound. What I think it's about is our lack of connection.
Yeah. Person to person.
Person to person, and that ache and that pain and that suffering that comes from a huge desire to be loved and wanted.
Yep.
And when we look at our families, about how they've been disintegrating, I mean, I can't remember what the statistics are about the number of children that are growing up in poverty right now. I think it's about 40% of our children are now being raised in poverty.
In this country.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think, I wish I could remember, I used to have these numbers right at the tip, but the number of people being raised in single-parent families.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's anything wrong with single-parent families.
Right.
I did that. But what it means is there are fewer resources.
Mm-hmm.
There are fewer people to love that child.
Right.
And that's why what you're talking about fits.
Mm-hmm.
About people needing more caring, loving adults.
Mm-hmm.
For them in the world. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite researchers was a gal by the name of Emily Werner, who worked with, you know, do you know of her study?
Name's familiar.
Yeah, she worked with something like 700 children being raised in poverty in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And studied them for 40 years.
Oh, wow.
And the ones who made it out were the ones who had a caring adult in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, in my mind, what you're talking about is,
it could be the
we
Mr.
need
God.
To be a caring uh-huh. adult for mm-hmm. each other in our lives.
Yeah.
And I mean,
and the one of the points I'm making is that you don't know where that's going to come from.
That's right.
Because when I was living at Tassajara, and I guess during interim or something, I went out to go see the guys at AAA to get car insurance, and I was just sitting on a bench waiting for whoever my agent was. And after a minute, I noticed someone was standing there. And I looked up, and there was this portly, middle-aged gentleman with a bunch of folders under one arm, standing there, kind of beaming at me. And it was the most wonderful encounter with this guy. He was just an insurance agent. But he was so present, right? I just felt so totally taken care of by this guy. I'd never set eyes on him before, nor he me. And all he was doing was being there completely.
One of my other favorite stories was this fellow whose life was saved by the people at Domino's Pizza because he hadn't ordered his pizza that night.
And they noticed.
And they noticed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they called the police and saved his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we have these opportunities.
So these resources are there. The question is, okay, why aren't people getting connected to them who need them so badly? Yeah. So that's your job. That's your job description. We got that all figured out. And now we can go home and go to sleep. I think I've kept you up too late. Yep, 10 to 9. Any other questions or comments? Yes, please. There you go.
So that book we're not supposed to name? That book we're not supposed to name?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got it in your library, I think.
Yeah, I. So that was actually my first Zen book as
well. There you are.
And I probably hadn't read it, you know, that was, I don't know, 30 years ago or something, 25 years ago, 30 years ago. And I recently reread it, and I was really struck by when the first time I read it, all I got out of it was, you need to have enlightenment and everything's fine.
Yeah.
You know? But when I reread it, they said over and over and over and over again, you know, awakening is just the first step.
Right.
And it was interesting how I just wasn't ready to hear that the first time I read it, you know.
Awakening is like, it's, you could call it an initiatory experience, but we have those all the time, right? So to think that they have to look a certain way is unnecessarily limiting. Suzuki Roshi went so far as to say, it's a kind of a trick. And when I actually impoliticly said that to Robert Aitken, and he was what? Okay, never mind. But I believe I know what Suzuki Roshi meant. It's a good trick, he said. It's a good trick. But it's a kind of a trick. Yeah. Sort of like when, you remember, Carlos Castaneda was studying with Don Juan, and Don Juan got him to piss off this witch. You remember that story? That's fantastic, right? Don Juan says, okay, here's a magical deer horn, and I want you to get out there and go and stick her with it. And poor Carlos is like, what? No, I can't do that. Yes, I'm, you know, you got to do it. So he goes out there and he approaches her. She sees him coming, and she's got this big smile on her face, right? And he goes, yeah. And all of a sudden, she's not there. Right? And he turns around. She's several feet away, still smiling. So he gets very confused. And he goes and gets back in the car, and he turns to Don Juan, and Don Juan says, don't turn your back on that woman. And he turns around. She's right next to the car. And Don Juan says, get out of here, now. So he steps on the gas, and they go racing off. And Carlos is like, shit, what the hell was that? And he suddenly he notices Don Juan is laughing. He's like, and he's like, what are you laughing about? And he said, well, okay, you know what? She's coming after you. You're going to have to learn sorcery now. A trick, right? Skillful means. Whether that actually happened or not, I don't know. The late abbot at Hartford Street, Philip Whalen, said, well, either Castaneda is telling the truth or he's one of the greatest novelists since Dickens. So, who knows? Okay. You guys, thank you very much.